crazier, too.
No, I actually left it. I stayed in the hotel one night a week.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Good morning, committee. It looks like we have a light agenda, but I don't think it will be too light.
Objection.
A point of order.
Yeah, point of order. Thank you for the correction. I'm sorry. I screwed that up. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
It is Friday. We're concluding our second week, and I appreciate the committee's indulgence. We've been listening to a wide range of bills, and today is no different. Today we're going to be hearing some bills mostly around collective bargaining issues. And before we get started, I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee bills.
Chair Holvey, I move that LC 2100 dated January 8th, 2015 and LC 3594 dated February 6th, 2015 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Barton moves LC 2100 dated January 8th, 2015 and LC 3594 dated February 6th, 2015 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Not seeing any discussion. Is there any objection? Not seeing any objection. Then the bills are, LCs are introduced as committee bills. And I will close the work session. And committee, I think we're going to start at the bottom of the agenda. And therefore, I'm going to open House Bill 2544.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires the issue subject to collective bargaining during the term of agreement that is not resolved through negotiation or mediation to be resolved through binding arbitration. It requires the matter to be submitted for mediation before binding arbitration, and it prohibits public employees from striking when the issue subject to collective bargaining during the term of agreement is subject to binding arbitration. There are no amendments before you.
And to get us started, Representative Doherty, if you'd like to introduce yourself and give us a little primer of what this bill's about.
I would love to. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the state representative from House District 35, which is Tigard in southwest Portland. Just as a little bit of a background to myself and the House Bill 2544, this is the second time this has come to the committee. Last session, went through the committee and actually passed the floor of the House. But a little background on my work background. For over 25 years, I bargained public employee collective bargaining agreements. And in my capacity as a UNISERV consultant with the Oregon Education Association, I also did arbitration process grievances, did a lot of trainings and so on. And I was the UNISERV consultant in 2003 in the Hillsborough School District when they made the New York Times, Mother Jones, and other publications for closing down their doors in the middle of May because of the financial crisis we had. And the reason for that is that the state of Oregon said, well, schools, I know that we have a two-year biennium figure of money, but the last 6 months we're not going to give you much, if any. And so that was the year that literally every school district, except for a very few, closed down, had days throughout the year. Hillsborough happened to be one of the very few, if the only one, that closed down totally in the middle of May, shut their doors, and the school year was over. During that time, that was the first time in all of those years I had seen interim bargaining. And what this bill calls for is that once a contract has been agreed to, if either side wants to reopen the contract in the middle of the contract, that they have the process to do it, and it ends in the remedy. If you are a unit that can strike where public safety can't, you have the remedy of strike. But I had never seen interim bargaining until that time. And at that time, probably every school district UNISERV consultant sat down with management and said, because they had no money, and we worked it out. We were not always happy with the results, but we knew that it was a situation and we would do that. I think since that time, with a very few exceptions and very bad exceptions, management and labor sits down and talks the problems out. Because usually good management is not going to bring up an interim bargaining issue if there is not a total need. During regular bargaining, what happens, and this is a process in Oregon, and I started teaching the year that the collective bargaining law for public employees went in. Actually, it was the year before. And so I've lived under no collective bargaining, and I've lived under collective bargaining. And with regular bargaining, we bring out all the issues, and we go through, and we, you know, try to resolve them. And if it's not resolved, there's a process for resolution, which ends in strike. It is getting a little more common now with public entities to go through and finish a contract, and very, very soon after that contract, a very dicey issue will be brought up in interim bargaining. And so I personally view this as you couldn't get it in regular bargaining, and so what you're trying to do is circumvent the system. I'm be very blunt and honest. But the cases of those are very, very rare. I would say 99% of management sits down and says, we have a problem, let's work it out. The one thing that, so it's not used very much. I know that you received a couple of letters from cities about this issue in interim bargaining and how it will cost a lot of money and so on and so forth. And I just want you to keep in mind that, some of the cities that you're hearing from have never used interim bargaining. And they've never asked for interim bargaining because they've been able to sit down with their unions and go through and resolve the issues. And so I think what is very important in deciding this issue is to talk to the cities and ask them if they've ever used that process or whether they've gone through and done this. If the situation is so dire, we do sit down and talk to people, but I think that in management, and you know, we usually come up with a solution. The reason we have binding arbitration in this, and the only difference between this, our proposal, and what current law is we change the final remedy from strike to binding arbitration. If you are management, or if you are the union and have brought up interim bargaining, and it is such a dire situation, you have the facts to win an arbitration, period. If you are doing it because you couldn't go through and get it through regular bargaining, then you don't have the facts and you are not going to prevail in an arbitration. Arbitrations are not $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 tabs unless you're doing an entire contract. Granted, I've been out for 10 years, but I've never even gotten close to that kind of a charge in an arbitration. And so many times in interim bargaining, if you're doing that, it is one issue. So binding arbitration is something that hopefully neither side takes lightly. When I worked for the union, we took binding arbitration very seriously because it set a precedence. It not only set a precedence, it pretty much said, this is what your contract says, this is what you're going to have to live by. And so at least I can speak from the union side of it, we take it very, very seriously because we know what the ramifications can be in losing an arbitration, and we're very, very hesitant to take something to arbitration that's not going to prevail. So I think what the bottom line is 99% of all management is pretty good about sitting down and talking about issues. What this bill is to deal with the, you know, we hate to say bad actors, but deal with the bad actors that go through and in my opinion, purposely wait until interim bargaining to get issues that they would not be able to resolve in the regular bargaining process. So, you know, let's recognize that management and labor do try to work together to resolve issues, but let's also realize some don't and that they need to go through and prove their case. And I'm open for questions.
Questions from the committee, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Doherty, you mentioned under dire situations, mm-hmm. they usually do sit down, and mm-hmm. I would assume this example that you gave back when you were mm-hmm. in education was one of those dire examples, and that ended up with the two management and the union representatives sitting down and working that out. So If that works out in dire situations, then I would ask, why would there need to be legislation here that in it seems would just open up the door for a lot more?
Well, Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, I think the reason is some of the examples, and I think you'll be hearing some of the examples this morning, are you know, when I talk dire, 99.9% of it is money, is that they've got a lack of funds and so on and so forth. What it is that there have been cases where money issues that they knew could not be resolved in bargaining. I mean, they literally have gone through in a very, very short time after the collective bargaining has been agreed to for a 2 or 3 or 4 year period, they have come in and asked for interim bargaining and dealt with an issue, whether it be subcontracting, whether it be furlough days, whether it be ever, very, very close to the resolution of the contract prior. And so it you kind of look and say, why didn't you bring it up in regular bargaining? And these were very, very complex issues that would have taken more time. And in the interim bargaining process, it's a little shorter process. You know, the reality is it's very hard to take people out on strike. And if you look at the collective bargaining law in Oregon, we have very, very few compared to most states. And the state of Washington, like with teacher, Washington State is illegal to strike. In Oregon, it is not. And we have far fewer strikes over, you know, the past 30 years than they have in the state of Washington. But it's very hard to mobilize people to go out on strike over either one issue or one small group of employees. And it's also a little hard if it's been timed to the point that maybe you're a public employee, a classified employee in a school district, and the time that you'd be able to go out on strike is summer when you're not working. And so that's... It's those instances that this will maybe have those guys think twice and let's do it in the regular collective bargaining.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Yeah. I guess my question would be, this affects more than just teachers, though.
Yes, it affects cities, counties, any public employee. Yeah. Cities, counties, states.
Right. So, and it's just teachers that have the summers off, so that only pertains to the education, and that's what you're testifying is more the education.
No. What the example I used, and first of all, they don't get summers off because they don't get paid. It's kind of like a forced kind of furlough, so let's keep that straight. School employees don't get paid in the summertime. They don't get paid for when they're not working. But what this is the idea that that is one sector of public sector, I mean, you know, as opposed to year-round employees, that you can go through and time it so a strike would occur when they're not, you know, not working.
Other questions? Representative Doherty, thank you for introducing this particular bill in committee and audience. I apologize, but now that Representative Doherty has got us thinking about 2544, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2544. There are some people that need to leave and testify on a different bill, so I'm going to go ahead and get that one out of the way. Getting it out of the way may not be the correct terminology, but regardless, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2213.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure makes on-the-job safety issues and employment relations subject to collective bargaining for employees of the Department of Corrections who have direct contact with inmates. There are no amendments today.
Thank you. First, we have, looks like a team of Beck Gallagher, Nick Cavall, and Steve Caputo. Close enough. Not sure whether it's my glasses or your penmanship.
We'll call it your glasses.
Oh. Brave individual. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Steve Caputo, and I'm the vice president for AOCE at Mill Creek Correctional Facility, and I'm a food service coordinator. I've been working with DOC for 14 years.
Good morning, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Becky Gallagher. I am an attorney for the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees.
Good morning, Chair Hulvey and members of the Business and Labor Committee. My name is Nick Cobol. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I represent the correction professionals who are not DPST, SST certified. I've been with the Department of Corrections as an HVAC technician for 16 years.
And if all right with you, Chair Hovey and members of the committee, I was going to begin with introductions of why we are here to support House Bill 2213. As I said, I am an attorney for the Association of Oregon Corrections Attorneys. I have been practicing almost 17 years. I am a partner in the law firm of Fenwick and Gallagher, where we specialize in public safety labor bargaining. We are here to talk about House Bill 2213 and how it relates to the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. That is a union that represents close to 800 men and women who work for the Department of Corrections at four different institutions. Those include the Maximum Security Oregon State Penitentiary, the Medium Security Oregon State Correctional Institute, and two minimum securities, Mill Creek Correctional Facility and South Fork Forest Camp. We are here to talk about the definition of employee relations and how it relates to our ability to bargain safety issues on the job as they arise. When this was added back in 2007, it gave us the ability to bargain with the Department of Corrections over on-the-job safety issues or changes, but solely as it relates to the officers, corporals, and sergeants that AOCE represents. It did not give them authority to bargain over changes that might impact nurses, food service coordinators, chaplains, physical plant, correctional counselors, all employees who have direct contact with inmates daily, just like the officers, corporals, and sergeants do. So what we are here to do is try and expand that statute so it would cover collective bargaining over safety-related issues for that group of employees with direct contact of inmates who don't qualify as strike prohibited under the statute. The interesting piece here is this was drafted specifically for strike prohibited individuals under the law enforcement definition. However, we have a mixed bargaining unit. So we have strike prohibited as well as strike permitted. But the way the law is written, it makes us a mixed unit. Therefore, the entire group does go to interest arbitration over contract or issues and cannot strike. So while they technically cannot strike because of the law, they're not defined as strike prohibited, and so they aren't able to bargain over safety-related issues. So we're here trying to amend and fix that today. We have some examples. Mr. Koval and Mr. Caputo will go over those. I was just going to give you a brief description of a recent issue we went over and why this really came to light. For instance, at the Oregon State Penitentiary Maximum Security Institution on death row, an issue came up about whether or not inmates should be allowed to self-administer insulin injections. So AOCE was able to file a bargaining demand on how that related to the safety of the officers who would have to work there with those inmates, but we couldn't bargain over how it related to the safety of the nurses handing out the insulin injections or the counselors or others working there. So we feel there really is a hole that we're trying to fix so that anyone with that direct inmate contact can now bargain over safety. I do know that you may have questions about financial impact. We have filed numerous bargaining demands with the Department of Corrections over safety-related changes since 2007, and I mean numerous. They've all been just officers, corporals, sergeants. Not a single one of those has gone to interest arbitration. Not a single one of those has resulted in the Department of Corrections bringing in an attorney. They were all handled at the bargaining table with the Department of Administrative Services. So by giving us the ability to bargain these safety-related issues, we can file that bargaining demand, bring them to the table, and in every single one of those instances, they resulted in a resolution that did not involve mediation or arbitration. Thank you very much. I encourage you to support House Bill 2213. Did you have any questions, or would you like to hear from the others first?
Let's go ahead and hear the rest.
Fantastic.
Here we go. All right.
Or do you want him to go first?
Okay.
You go.
I'll go first. Chair Hovey and members of the House Business and Labor Committee, and sorry for skipping that the first time around. In my duties as a food service coordinator, what it is I basically oversee a group of inmates who prepare, serve, and clean up after the meals. In the production area, the inmates have access and use knives, and we're talking 12-inch knives. We also use some smaller ones. These are tethered to a table, but they still have a reach of 2 to 3 feet. They use large mixing utensils that basically are a metal boat oar. Recently at OSP, one was used as a weapon to brain another inmate. Now, while that was an inmate-on-inmate attack, it's still a concern to us for our personal safety because there's collateral damage. Just because someone's swinging at another inmate doesn't mean that we're going to be in the arc of the throw also. And so there's a real danger involved there, especially with the access to these kinds of implements that can be used as weapons. The inmates are very ingenious in manufacturing weapons from any kind of an item. That's why we have to secure and count all tools. It's amazing what they could do with a spatula, a carrot peeler. And these can all be used as weapons, and they can be used against us, and they can be used against inmates. Attacking another inmate can be used as a diversion to then launch a collateral attack against us as staff, and it has been done. Another issue that we have to be careful about, and has happened, is that an attack will not come frontal. It will come from the side, it will come from behind. It may come after an altercation that happened 2 weeks ago that will wait their time. We have a staff member who, while he was patting down and letting inmates out through a gate, was attacked by a larger inmate and was being beaten on until staff could respond. Now, the problem is that security can't just break through that door and come in and rescue you. They've got to go through several locked doors that have to be sometimes opened by other staff because they don't have the key for it. So sometimes a person who's being attacked will have to hold on for 30 seconds, a minute and a half, until support comes. And that is something that we have to be very conscious of. When we enter a room, when I am going into the production area and I have my six cooks, I have my four dishwashers, when I walk into the room, it's not just that I walk into the room. I have to walk into the room and visually see where everybody is, make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, and be aware of anything that looks suspicious. That is a constant part of my job and my daily activities. You have to have this heightened level of awareness and vigilance, not only for my safety, but for my coworkers' safety, and also for the safety of the inmates, because we are responsible for that too, and that is a large part of our job. It's not just protecting ourselves, it's protecting the inmates from each other. Is that good? Okay. So that's just a brief overview of what I do daily. So I will turn you over to my counterpart over there. I urge you to support House Bill 2213, and thank you for your time.
Chair Hovey, members of the House Business Later Committee. I have two positions, so I'll go over my first position. That is my job. I take inmates from the minute I go into the institution. I'm around inmates. In my daily duties, I can take inmates into tunnels or mechanical chases without cameras, without communications to anybody for up to 5 hours at a time. And so I'm left on my own accord to deal with these inmates. In the 16 years that I've been with the department, I've had three instances personally that I've had to deal with, right, where security wasn't around to help me. And so we rely on your own resources. Right? They turned out well, but I can't say that somebody in the same position would turn out as well. The one case that, the worst case that happened is when I did get the inmate to a officer, it took six officers to put him down. What I need to think is if I would engage the inmate, I'd have been in trouble. I deal with nurses, and we've lost one nurse because of a brutal beating. She finally quit, and they're left alone at their own accord. There's no training for these people. They had one officer on the floor, and the rest of the nurses locked themselves in a room until support could get there. Compounding our problem is that the DOC has done away with safety managers in a safety department. Right? That doesn't mean that they don't care about safety. It doesn't mean that each institution doesn't have their own safety committee, but they have no one overseeing how the safety committee is doing. So it's left up to, basically it's left up to representative staff to how good your safety committee is. The biggest difference is, like I said in my opening statement, is that we take the same or more risks when we enter that institution. No officer is going to hand an inmate a 12-inch knife and turn his back on them. Hand power tools and all kinds of other things in construction to these inmates. For the most part, it goes well. But all it takes is an inmate that's off his meds. We don't have training for that. We have to figure out whether how our inmate's doing that day. If he's off his meds or something is wrong, great, it's up to us to figure out or handle the situation or get him the help that he needs. As Becky said, right, this allows us to take things to the table to discuss. if we, correction professionals, bring something up to the table, we have to be creative, because if they don't want to talk to us, they say it's permissive subject of bargaining, and we have no choice. So we get creative and attach an officer to an officer. So hopefully you can see that we support this bill. And if you got any questions, happy to answer.
Questions of this panel from the committee? Representative Nose.
It's not really a question, it's more just a comment, which is to my colleagues, I would just say that this isn't going to compel the employer to reach an agreement. It just means that they have to talk about it, right? That's the main thing here, which is you can't dodge the bullet by this being a permissive subject of bargaining, therefore we don't even have to discuss it with you. The idea is we get to talk about this at the table and attempt to try to make a resolution. Is that the best way? Okay.
And then, like I said, in the 7 years that I've been in this position, we've talked many issues. I can't see where it's cost the department any money. We've usually worked it out.
Other questions, Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess sometimes it seems like some of the crazy stuff that happens with state government or the federal government, where they're doing things wrong, where the private sector isn't so much on a lot of these issues. So you're telling me that each department has, well, I guess first I want to go to the nurse. I mean, you said where they're basically administering insulin, things like that, and it would probably go into the other stuff. None of this, I wouldn't see it as collective bargaining issues, as safety issues, because I'm huge on the safety side of things. And this isn't brought up in any issues when you're working in a facility or anything like that. They don't assign a guard to you guys. You're out on your own the whole time, and you're not backed up, anything like that? Because what I'm hearing is you were by yourself and attacked, or came close to attack or something like that. Yeah, and then you have a nurse that was beaten up and nobody's around for any of this stuff.
One officer for the entire infirmary. You have different offices on the floor. The infirmary is separate, but it's still on the same floor. So we're not sure what the inmate was on, but it took, he was beaten down with a set of handcuffs until the help to get him there. You can do what you do to control the situation, but then you have one officer, what's happening around the situation? Does it turn into a feeding frenzy where the other inmates are going to start attacking? That's what we deal with.
If I may, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, just to the question specifically is why is this collective bargaining as opposed to a work rule? We certainly do have post orders from the Department of Corrections, policies and procedures that all of these staff work under. But to the extent AOCE wants to come to the table and say, we believe that the way this area in the institution is run is unsafe, we only get to do that right now as it relates to the correctional officer series, not the rest of the non-correctional officer staff. So what we're really trying to do is, like we said before, we can try, but their response could be, that's a management right to make that change in working conditions, because right now you aren't technically a strike-prohibited law enforcement officer. So we're trying just to make sure we do have that power to effectuate those changes if necessary.
I guess I may follow up.
Follow up.
Because in private industry, you have OSHA that has a lot of the regulation and guidelines. And there's nothing like that for corrections at all.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, there is OSHA, and we have in the past had to call, for instance, with the lack of any sort of fire protection gear in the special housing unit. A fire breaks out. We've had some smoke issues without fire gear for the counselors and the nurses there. We didn't technically have the ability to bargain, but for the officers, we did, who were stuck down there with our mental health unit, our mental health inmates. We could certainly call OSHA. That ends up being oftentimes costly for the Department of Corrections as well if they're ordered to make changes. Our preference is to be able to sit, discuss, and come up with a change we can live with. But we do have the right to call OSHA and have in the past.
Other questions? I want to thank you very much for coming this morning and expressing your concerns over your ability to bring safety issues to the table. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead and finish this. Up next, we have Nancy Bogkin.
Oh,
Mary, I'm sorry. I thought you were tired.
Hi, Nancy.
Nancy. I told you it was my glasses. Really have
maybe
difficult.
If you took them off.
Yeah, if I take them off, maybe I'd do better.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, sir. This is my first session, as opposed to.
Yeah, right.
For the record, Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing AFSCME corrections officers and staff. And yes, I did leave. But was immediately contracted to manage corrections and PERS. So while I left, you didn't get rid of me. So we are here in favor of this legislation. We represent 1,300 non-security or security plus staff in Oregon's prisons. We have, of the 14 prisons, we represent 12 of them. And this has been a huge issue for our non-security personnel. I think the previous panel did a good job of outlining the security and safety issues that they face every day. And we would encourage the committee to really seriously consider allowing this bill to proceed. In our experience, in all of the institutions that we represent and all the staff that we have, we've only issued one demand to bargain, and it did not go to arbitration. So we've been able to resolve a lot of the safety issues through work with the institution and the Department of Corrections. You know, with increasing inmate populations and the increased use of emergency housing units, which are not designed to house inmates on a 24/7 basis but are being used that way, safety has become an increasing problem for both the security and the non-security staff. So we would really encourage you to act promptly on this bill and let it move forward and give the non-uniform staff the same protection that our uniform staff have.
Thank you. Any questions of this? Just one question. So you think passing this bill will have an impact of improving safety at these facilities?
You know, I think it gives the team, the union team, another tool in their toolbox to manage safety in the institution. And I think the previous panel outlined some of the issues of, you know, it is not just our job to keep each other safe. It is our job to keep the inmates safe. And with all the increased requirements under the Prison Rape Elimination Act, you know, these folks are really put in an awkward situation when they don't have safety tools that they need to work every day.
Representative Doherty.
A quick question. I'm under the assumption that the people that actually work, like with their food service, nurses, you know, maintenance, whatever, might have a better idea as to what sort of safety things they may need. Is that one of the reasons to have that,
it really as part is. Of collective bargaining? It's the same, you know, when you do one job every day, you know what your challenges are. And I think that they have a better idea, folks who are working on the ground in the units with the inmates have a better idea of what they need to keep them safe and their inmate work team safe than somebody working at the dome building.
Okay.
And my final question is, I noticed this bill does not have an emergency clause on it, and curious whether you think passing this bill and getting it into law sooner has the potential of bringing more safety to the job sites sooner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is not an AFSCME bill, so I would not presume to add language to somebody else's bill, but we would, if the authors of the bill want to add an emergency clause, we would certainly support that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll find out from them later.
Yep.
How necessary.
It's their bill. We'll let them decide.
How necessary they think it is to move this sooner rather than later into law. Not seeing any other. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2213? Not seeing any. With that, I will close public hearing on House Bill 2213. And I would like to reopen the hearing on House Bill 2544. Committee, as you recall, Representative Doherty led us off introducing this bill, and our next testifiers are Joe Basler and Stacy Chamberlain.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler, and I represent Oregon AFSCME, the American Federation of State and County Municipal Employees. We represent about 24,000 members around the state, and the vast majority are in the public sector. We are a strong proponent of this bill. We've worked with Representative Doherty on bringing it forward, and it's very important to us. I think it's so important to us because I think a core function of our not only our organization, but our belief system is collective bargaining and figuring out a way to come with the employer and work out through a process the right way to get things done. And collective bargaining works best when it's an open process where everyone knows what's on the table and we can go back and forth and come to a reasonable solution. And we really feel like this process of expedited bargaining or interim bargaining, our folks call it interim bargaining, the statute calls it expedited bargaining, which, by the way, was incredibly confusing for me for the first 2 months we were working on this, but I figured it out now. It feels like a shortcut in a lot of ways. It only happens so a contract is signed, it is in place, then the employer wants to make a change to the employment terms for something that is not in the contract, not spelled out in the contract, but is a mandatory subject of bargaining. So let's say you didn't have furlough days in your contract because you didn't intend to do furlough days, so you probably wouldn't put it in the contract. And then the employer says, well, you know, the contract's in place, but we're going to do furlough days. So, you know, you have 90 days then to bargain over those furlough days. And at the end of 90 days, it gets implemented. We will get letters that say into effect, in 90 days, you'll get 5 furlough days. There's no impetus to come to an agreement. There's no reason to sort of solve this problem. I mean, there is the possibly we could go into strike after 90 days. That would be incredibly disruptive and incredibly hard. And also, we don't think it's a shock. We are not big fans of going on strike. And so it is very sort of, it's a very hard process. It feels very, very much like a short circuit. So a lot of our members would love to get rid of the process entirely, make it go away. We don't necessarily think that's a good idea either. I mean, there are scenarios where it makes sense to do this, but there's no check on it. There's no check on it right now. So what we wanted to do is, at the end of the 90 days, a mediation period to try to see if we can still work something out. And if that doesn't work, then enter into binding arbitration to sort of go to a neutral arbiter and say, hey, this is what we want to do. The arbiter, the union says, well, we would prefer you did this. And the arbiter decides which one. You know, it's a process that works for those units that are strike barred. In fact, right now, expedited bargaining happens right now for those strike barred groups. That's what happens. They go to binding arbitration. IRB has just made that ruling. I don't think that most employers are seeking to sort of short circuit the collective bargaining process, but this is a really, really easy tool because it has no check to it. I just think that that's sort of where we're at. I also brought with me Stacy Chamberlain, who's our collective bargaining director, to sort of give some more examples to sort of flesh it out. And hopefully, if you have any good technical questions, she can answer them. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Stacy Chamberlain. As Joe said, I'm the collective bargaining director for Oregon AFSCME Council 75. And bargaining is about the balance of power, right, at the bargaining table. That's an essential function of being able to bargain. When we go to the bargaining table, both the union and employers are bringing forward proposals. We both have an agenda of things that we want to accomplish and get done at the bargaining table. And there's pressure on both the union and the employer to reach that agreement. with the employer being able to implement their proposal and the union being able to strike if we're unable to reach an agreement. So we're usually pretty successful in getting to agreement. When we have to go into interim bargaining or forced into interim bargaining, that balance is lost. And we really think a game begins with the employer. Because the employer knows that once they provide us notice of their intent to change a mandatory subject to bargaining, which is typically regarding wages, hours, and working conditions, they just have to wait us out 90 days. And on that 91st day, they can implement whatever they want. And so what we see happen quite often is that we get the notice, and sometimes it's very shortly after we've completed a full bargaining process. Sometimes it's right after we ratify and before the ink is even dry on the signature page of the contract. And so the 90 days happens, and on the 91st day, the employer will implement their proposal. And it's usually their original proposal. They'll meet with us a couple times, but it's not really bargaining because there's no impetus, there's no pressure on them to actually have a real discussion about what goes on. And so it actually incentivizes employers not to bring issues forward during regular bargaining, but wait and bring them forward during the interim bargaining process when they can actually get things then that they otherwise probably would not have been able to get through the regular bargaining. And I have a couple of examples of how we've seen this work. I have many examples, but I won't bore you with all of them. But in Lane County, for example, they had pretty contentious bargaining right after they ratified the agreement, and according to the rep, before the signatures were even on the signature page of the agreement, the county came to us and said, we want to implement a drug and alcohol policy. And we have drug and alcohol policies in a lot of our collective bargaining agreements. That's fine. But we've had lots of discussions, and they usually come up during the regular course of bargaining. Because this came up so close to reaching an agreement on a complete collective bargaining contract, we filed an unfair labor practice saying they should have been forced to have this discussion during bargaining. Because of this law, they said, nope, interim bargaining applies. And surprise, surprise, on the 91st day, they had a new drug and alcohol policy that had very, if any, changes from the original proposal that the county brought forward. Had we had arbitration in place, I think two things probably would have happened. Either the employer would have brought this forward during regular bargaining, which they should have, this shouldn't have been a surprise, or there would have been pressure on them to actually reach an agreement with the union during this interim bargaining process to get done, and that would have restored some balance. Another example happened in 2011 on April 13th, 2011, the Columbia County notified the union that they were going to implement 26 furlough days in the next calendar year. A lot of furlough days. And we met with the employer a few times during that 90 days. And then on July 13th, we were notified that they were going to implement 24 furlough days because they missed two because of the 90 days. But that was it. That was the only change that they made from their original proposal, and that really had to do with the timing, not because of some discussion that they had with the union. We brought forward proposals and alternatives, none of which were heard by the employer. And then a final example, we were having a member come down to testify about what happened at the city of Portland recently. On April 30th of 2014, we reached an agreement with the city of Portland after a very lengthy bargaining process. And on May 14th, before the contract was signed, the city came forward saying that they were going to change this classification that they had to a board classification and drop the pay. They were going to add some other duties to it and drop the pay of the classification. Of course, we wanted to demand to bargain over it. And my understanding was the city even understood some of the rationale of why we objected to that, and in the end the city said, well, you know, we're so close to bargaining, which I don't quite understand because they just finished bargaining, that we're not going to implement those changes. We're just going to go ahead and do what we want to do. And I hear those stories a lot from my staff. You know, little changes to classifications, little issues that come up that really should be discussed during the regular course of bargaining that are only brought up during this interim bargaining process because there's no incentive not to, right? They actually get rewarded for waiting to this interim bargaining process because they're going to get exactly what they want. So I think the other issue I think Joe touched on a little bit was this ability to strike. There's some confusion in the law whether or not we even have the ability to strike as an option. Most of our contracts have language in them which contain a strike bar, meaning that during the course of the collective bargaining agreement, we're not allowed to go out on strike. So when an interim bargaining issue comes up, we have a strike bar in place. So there's been a lot of discussion on whether or not that applies to interim bargaining. But the fact of the matter is, even if we are allowed to go out on strike, it doesn't really fit the spirit of the PECFA, right? The spirit of the PECFA is to be able to resolve these issues and not disrupt government during the course of a contract. Forcing the union to go out on strike on a classification issue or a drug and alcohol policy or furloughs when we can have it resolved through a quick arbitration process fits more in line with what the purpose of the PECFA really is. And so I think that this House bill actually restores the balance that we need in order to get bargaining back on track, to make the discussions that should be occurring at the bargaining table happen at the bargaining table, and then when issues come up that need to be dealt with during the interim, that there's pressure on both sides to actually have a good discussion and reach a good agreement.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Doherty.
I just kind of a question of clarification. When you talk about a furlough day, that means a day without pay. Is that correct? So if you have like, and I don't know how what it is in your business. In the teacher business, it's a 0.5% of salary. So I don't know what it is in your business. So the 26 days could be a 13% pay cut.
Right.
They would just implement.
Yeah. Every other Friday they head off.
And if you force somebody to get out and strike, you get the furlough days anyway.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
But it doesn't, you know, they plan for the furlough days, so unlike a strike that is a little more difficult to plan for.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Hope you have a good weekend. Up next, gosh, I'm going to have to get somebody else to read these names. New glasses. Anna Canwit and Andy Smith and Scott Winkles. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. League of Oregon Cities is a association that represents all 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon. I've been working on collective bargaining issues since my first session in 2007. I would offer, before I get into my particulars on the bill, I would offer one observation, is that one thing I don't think I have ever seen is a committee bring up the Employment Relations Board to talk about the bill and present the implications of it. I think there's a way to do that that would provide everybody a similar set of set facts. I think some of these issues can become contentious. Allegations can fly. It can become a heated debate, and having the impartial you can bring the ERBS management and labor rep or the neutral rep and give their perspective on how the bill works and how it would be implemented would be very valuable in keeping the peace and stability of the building inside the Capitol. And we would encourage you to do that at some point on this bill as well. And I'd point out that both parties respect that ERB process, and we have a ceasefire agreement when it comes time for the ERB budget, where we both all go up and encourage the legislature to fund that. So, and with that, I want to bring up some of the issues, some of the drivers that would bring an employer, make an employer open up a contract during the life of the CBA. One is clearly an unforeseen circumstances. So, you know, City of Gene, they needed to open up their contract because they had to make changes to their take-home car policy. some issues came up and they needed to address that contract. I think that is not an issue that rises to the level of where you would want to expose that to binding arbitration. A binding arbitration can run, an arbitrator cost can run between $4,000 to $16,000 in process, depending on how long it goes. That's an expensive, time-consuming process that I don't believe serves either parties. One of the other drivers to opening up a contract is, well, you, the legislature. When we make changes to things, to employee rights, to for instance, the sick leave that we'll be hearing on, this committee will be hearing on Monday, that contract gets opened. That's not a decision on the part of the employer. That's simply a matter, that's the legislature changing a law, and we need to address that in the CBA. Exposing those issues where, you know, the employer, it's not the employer's call, having to open up those contracts and exposing them to the binding arbitration process, we believe would be problematic, and I think it's an unintended consequence of the bill. What are the remedies in case there is an employer who is a bad actor, or a laborer is a bad actor, and we have a ULP process? If an employer is bad faith bargaining, there is a process. There is a grievance process. That grievance process works. It's a process both sides respect. I point out that the threshold for an employer to be found to have been bargaining bad faith is quite low. I'm aware of one case where the IRB found that a memo written by an employee who was not a part of the bargaining team and was not a decision maker was found to be evidence that the employer had predetermined their outcome and they were found to be in bad faith bargaining. That's a low standard in my mind, and there is a grievance process and there is a way to remedy these issues. And what are the impacts of this bill? I think one thing we need to talk about are service levels. If we take away management's tool, a management tool to address their financial needs and address their situation, then what it does is it vectors the employer towards a layoff. And layoffs affect our ability to provide services to the public. These are services people demand. It's if we can address something, an unforeseen financial circumstance through furlough day as opposed to layoff, then employer can still provide those services to the public. I don't think we want to drive employers to that situation. I would respectfully submit that the legislature hasn't been particularly open to significant local government finance reform. We have a situation where our property tax revenues are capped at 3%. Assessments are capped at a 3% raise per year, but there's no cap on costs, and that's a structural problem that needs to be addressed. I would also submit that that situation is what's driving a lot of these contracts and a lot of these financial pressures that are bringing these contracts open. Additionally, I would think that this bill would incentivize, if to the extent bad actors exist on both sides, I think it incentivizes them to act badly. I think if you can't get an issue, if you don't want an issue decided in a contract, then you can. It's probably too clever by half, but you could wait till the binding arb process and roll the dice in binding arb. And if you have an issue where you think that could lead to a strike, you can avoid that by going to the binding arb, where the bargaining unit loses that ability. I'm actually kind of surprised that the Columbia County example with the furlough days didn't lead to a strike threat. That seemed like a significant blow to that contract. I think what we can do to improve this process and what the League has been historically willing to suggest is add mediation to it. We can extend the timelines. We're open to that conversation about extending the timelines and then insert mediation if we can't come to an agreement. I don't think a bad actor on either side could hide in that mediation process. I think if you're trying to play games, if you're trying to game the system, the mediation process, I think, is going to smoke that out, and we're going to have a ULP. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues or take questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andy Smith for the City of Portland, and with me today is Anna Kamwit, and she's our Human Resources Director. Thanks for the opportunity to address a few of our concerns about this bill. Anne is going to address those concerns, and then we'll both be available to answer questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Holby and representatives of the committee. I am Anna Canwood. I'm the Director of Human Resources for the City of Portland. We did submit written testimony, which I'm not going to cover in my remarks. At the outset, I want to stress that I, as the HR Director, I meet regularly with our union leaders, and I do agree with the statements that Representative Doherty brought up, that we are generally able to work out these issues in midterm bargaining. We have a number of memorandums of agreement that negotiate those changes that arise after a regular contract has been negotiated. That said, I do have real concerns about this bill. It does upset the current balance in the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. That statute recognizes with midterm bargaining the need to address issues that come up after regular bargaining in a very quick manner, hence why it's a 90-day process for bargaining rather than the 150 days for regular bargaining. The issues that we deal with, they're not issues that we were aware of when we were bargaining our regular contracts. These are things that come up around changes in public policy from our city commissioners, information and requests they get from our various city citizen committees on how work should be done in the city, and resulting reorganizations in order to provide that new work. I think I may have mentioned, or Scott did, legislative changes that often have impacts on mandatory subject bargaining that we have to address. So there are a number of issues that arise that could not have been contemplated during regular bargaining. And in fact, if we were to wait for regular bargaining, basically, we wouldn't be making those changes at all. In the city, both between the management side and the unions, we've been negotiating lengthy contracts, 3 and 4 years, to ensure labor peace, to ensure that the wages and health benefits are set for employees so they know what to expect. Again, this is not something that can simply be, these issues are not things that can be put off to regular bargaining. One thing to remember, binding arbitration is what's been talked about with this bill. It is binding interest arbitration. That's not the same as regular binding arbitration. Interest arbitration requires the arbitrator to decide between two offers, the employer's offer and the union's offer. So it's not a matter of mixing and matching, coming up with perhaps the best solution, as you might achieve, for example, through a mediation process, but it is one side's offer or the other. The other piece of it, it's very lengthy. So again, having gone through these with contract negotiations on interest arbitration, they take a long time to schedule the hearing. Even with a simple issue, you're looking at 1 to 2 days of hearing. There's time built in for an arbitrator decision. There's time built in for post-hearing briefs. In this field, everyone writes briefs. there's no oral conclusions on these hearings. You're seriously talking about a delay of 3 to 6 months, and really it's 6 months before we would actually have a decision, both the union and the employer, on a midterm issue. And that ends up, again, if you're trying to make changes to address needs in terms of work provided to our citizens, economic downturns where the alternative is laying off employees, which we try not to do, it really is not a workable solution. Finally, as was mentioned, I think where there is a bad actor, there are remedies through ERB, and even when you make mistakes. For example, City of Portland made a mistake, and we didn't provide the proper notice for a change in the number of hours worked for our represented seasonal maintenance workers. ERB slapped our hand and said, "No, you didn't do this right, and you need to go back and bargain that." So there is a remedy, and again, it was not our intent, but there was a remedy for that action. So generally, in closing, I would submit that for the most part, these issues, we can work them out, and I think that a solution for those times where they are not worked out of a binding interest arbitration is really a very big hammer for what's in actuality a very small problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I want to appreciate your testimony this morning. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, Nancy Hungerford and Alan Barbie. Barber. Me. One of those.
Barber. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. This is Nancy Hungerford. I represent school districts, community colleges in collective bargaining, and have done so for almost 40 years. I've bargained over 400 contracts for those parties, always on the management side. And I would also indicate to you that I have the distinction, because I am the publisher and editor of the Oregon Labor Law Digest, of reading every arbitration decision reached in the state of Oregon for public employers in the last 38 years. And that includes everyone for interest arbitration, every grievance arbitration award. And so a lot of people question my sanity in that regard, but I do feel I have a good grasp on how those decisions come down and who's deciding. Today I want to talk to you a little bit about, I gave you copies of my remarks here, but I want to deviate from those and talk about unintended consequences. I agree with Representative Doherty that most of the time we are able to resolve these kinds of issues that come up between contract periods, and to do so maybe not amicably, but with a good faith, and come to the best possible resolution. But one of the reasons that that happens is because we do have the 90-day expedited bargaining, and that operates as a incentive for the parties to get to it, get to a resolution if they possibly can. So without that tool, and I would tell you that public employers, school districts, are not going to risk going through expedited bargaining if at the end of the road we have the only resolution would come from an outside arbitrator. Let's talk about that a little bit first. Our arbitrators come from a list of panel, a panel that the Employment Relations Board maintains. It's about 55, 65 people. At the current time, I would tell you that at least three-quarters of them are out-of-state people. They have no experience with the state of Oregon. You know, a whole lot of them are from Wisconsin right now, and I don't think that that's unusual. But because they are not people who have experience with the financing system in the state of Oregon and so forth, there's a steep learning curve. And essentially what this bill does is turn over decision-making from Oregon school boards, Oregon public employers, and Oregon public employees and their representatives to an outside party that has no involvement, no accountability, goes home, charges us for the freight, the costs for coming from St. Louis or Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or California, or some other place. And that's really what we're dealing with here in terms of imposing binding interest arbitration on, and I'm going to speak specifically for school districts and community colleges. Another unintended consequence of this bill, I believe, will be there will be shorter contracts. I'm not going to recommend to my clients, and we represent about 100 school districts in the state, the Hungerford Law Firm, I'm not going to recommend that they enter into long-term contracts if the consequence of that is that they can't make changes in the interim without going to binding interest arbitration. You know, the four-year contracts that we were able to achieve as part of maybe in the mid-2000-aught decade are unusual. We've gone through a period where everybody's bargaining every year because we've had so many financial issues that have arisen. But we would like to get back to a situation where we have, you know, three-year contracts, two-year contracts at least. This bill will pressure public employers to have shorter contracts because they can't risk having these issues come up and not having a way to resolve it without going through binding interest arbitration. And then here's the main unintended consequence. You've been told that expedited bargaining is something that is required when management wants to make a change in a mandatory issue. But that's not all, and that's not the chief impact of expedited bargaining. Because the Employment Relations Board has decided that even if it is a permissive matter, that the employer may not implement a change until you bargain over the impact of that. And on the back of my handout, I've given you four different situations, and they're all real situations that have come up in our practice. One of them is very like the situation that arose in the early 1990s, which was the reason why expedited bargaining was added to the bill. And when Senator Bryant introduced Senate Bill 750 in 1995, the expedited bargaining provision in that bill grew directly out of this case. And I know because I was in consulting with Senator Bryant. And it was a case where a school district named Tiger District intended to look at how they delivered services to students. They determined that a better school schedule would be a block schedule where teachers would be teaching three out of four periods during the day. The student schedule is a permissive matter. It is something that Employment Relations Board has decided long ago is not necessary to be bargained. But because there was a slight impact on teachers' student contact time as a result of this schedule change from a seven-period day to a block schedule, which has students coming every other day to classes and they go to class longer periods of time, it was necessary to bargain. This school district, first of all, entered into a process with its high school teachers to study this and come up with recommendations, and that went on for months. And in about January, the school board decided that going to the block schedule was the right way to go. A demand to bargain over not the decision, because that was not bargainable, but the impact, those minutes of student contact time, began. And that process was not finished until after school started, because we had to go through regular bargaining. We had to go through mediation. And mediation is not just 15 days. It takes you 1 to 2 months to get a mediator assigned to you. We had to, in those days, go through fact-finding, which time delays there were about what you're going to have with interest arbitration. You're going to have a period of time when you've got to wait for the arbitrator to be available. And school started, and our students didn't have their schedules. And the school district implemented a block schedule, but they had to hire substitute teachers in order to come in and relieve teachers for a short period during the time period. And it was a lengthy process that inhibited a school district from making a change in an area in which the legislature and ERB have recognized that these are school district decisions, student schedules. That's why this bill came about, this portion of the bill came about. And the instances I give you on the back page are exactly where the most use of expedited bargaining comes. It comes in situations where there is a permissive matter that the school board can decide, but it has impacts. We have to bargain those. But ERB has said we cannot implement the permissive change until we finish the entire process of bargaining over the impact. So when I speak about unintended consequences, I think that's the major one that we would be looking at is the fact that you're going to make a much longer bargaining process. School districts are not going to be willing to turn these decisions over because they really impact their ability to implement permissive matters.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Kinnemeyer.
Interrupting, but Nancy, you mentioned that you had submitted testimony.
Oh, okay.
We do not have it in the record, and we do not have it at the committee.
Okay.
At least that's my understanding. And since a lot of your testimony is based on reference to your material,
there
was a little problem following this. And I thought for a minute it was my inexpertise with my computer, but it's not.
Yeah. I thought that it had gotten hooked into your...
Yeah, no, somehow it did. I thought that would be helpful so you can have a little better discussion. Thank you.
That's, I think, the conclusion of my remarks. Alan Barber is here from one of...
if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
I will. My name is Alan Barber. I'm the Human Resources Director for Jackson County School District 9, which is the Eagle Point School District. Thank you for hearing me today. I heard some of my colleagues earlier talk about contentious bargaining, and I would dare say that many of you have heard of Eagle Point, and for many, many years it was probably synonymous with some of the most contentious bargaining in the state. I see a couple of heads nod.
Thank you.
We are almost 3 years out of an employee strike. which was an absolute terrible time for our community, for our students, for myself, for our teachers, for our classified employees. We're a wall-to-wall unit. But I will tell you that since that time, we have made such gains in our employee relationships. We have signed 9 MOUs in the past 18 months with a group that we call the Contract Language Review Team, which exists to discuss concerns about the contract. In the past 19 years, when all that contentious bargaining was taking place in Eagle Point, the district took 2 instances in which they utilized interim or expedited bargaining. And I believe those are both listed on a letter that you have there for me. And I think that's interesting to note that even in the most contentious of times, the school district only chose that route twice. Both times there was discussion. Both times the outcome was great for all involved parties. Most importantly, both times the outcomes of those interim bargaining sessions ended up in a good decision for the students. And I think that's important to note. In the last several years, the most recent one, I believe, was we had a change. We subcontracted out our food services. And that was a pretty interesting negotiating time right there. All of the employees retained their positions. We saved a lot of money. What did the money go to? Keeping teachers and providing better services for students. We have not cut a single school day. We've had 0 furlough days. We have a complete calendar for our students, which also means we have a complete salary for all of our employees. I think that's interesting to note. In the last 2 or 3 years, we've added more than 20 teaching positions because we have a balanced, sustainable budget. I heard one of the speakers at this table earlier talk about how management could use this interim bargaining just to get what they want after bargaining. If I'd have known that was a tool, I would have been using it more often. That's simply not the way that works. Interim bargaining is bargaining, and both sides get to bring things to the table, and if either side doesn't do what they're supposed to do, there are grievances and unfair labor practices, and HERB Board gets involved. So I think the most what scares me the most about this, and Nancy touched on it a little bit, is we don't want an outside entity telling us what to do. We already have a check for that. We have locally elected officials, school board members, that are charged with bargaining with the local union. And right now, our local union and our local school board have a great relationship, and it is working. I invite any of you to come and see it. Come to see it happen. We meet monthly. It's been a great time for us after an employee strike. I know that that's not probably what you expected to hear from an HR director. But we feel like this particular House bill will do more damage than good because, as Nancy said, it will keep us from moving for, you know, we have a 3-year contract right now. We actually signed our current contract 6 months prior to the expiration date. We have a 3-year contract where classified employees got an 8% raise, certified got a 6%, and all employee groups were eligible for almost 14-15% increase in steps during that time. This is during a bad economic time that we accomplished this, and this is because we have a great relationship with our administrative team and our local union. We don't want to bring someone from Wisconsin or California in to choose one side or the other. If they were to choose my side, would I be happy? Perhaps I would be happy, but I think that would be damaging to our relationship. Do I want them to choose their side? Same answer. It might make them happy, but it would damage a relationship. You have a letter that I wrote, and if you guys have questions, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. And we have still a lot of people to get through, so I appreciate your testimony, and we're hearing a lot of the same sort of stories and reflections on bargaining successes and failures, I suppose. Not seeing any questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, Lori Satinspiel, Rob Bovet, and Chuck White. And I would hope that you don't spend too much time repeating points and comments that have already been made.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'll take that admonition to heed, and I will basically say ditto to to what you've heard from the employer representatives, but I do want to cover, and I've covered it in my written testimony, but I do want to cover something that I heard earlier and respond to it at least a little bit and tell you briefly the story of Columbia County, because it was mentioned previously by the union representatives. So in Columbia County, of course, is one of our very distressed financial counties. In 2008-2009, they had to take some very serious austerity measures to try to wade through the Great Recession. And then they got hit with a double whammy in 2011 because Congress failed to do what it should have done with respect to rural Oregon counties and federal timber monies. This left a nearly $3 million hole in the Columbia County budget midterm. So that basically they were left with a couple of choices. They had to do a dramatic reduction in services, which meant basically laying off people or doing furlough days or some combination thereof. The County Board of Commissioners notified the union. They engaged in bargaining. The county's position was they wanted to do a combination of layoffs and furlough days. The furlough days that you heard previously, I think it was 24, if I recall. The union wanted to do something else, which would have resulted in a dramatically different outcome, a lot more layoffs and less furlough days, and potentially the elimination of certain county departments. The county chose to implement furlough days and a combination of furlough days and layoffs. And I guess I tell you all that because if this bill had been in place, the practical effect would have been a delay in implementation such that the only answer the county could have had was layoffs. And so there would be more people unemployed in Columbia County, the county government, as a result, and its hands would have been functionally tied. So, I also tell you, I guess as a punchline to the end, Columbia County's situation has gotten slightly better since then, and they've reduced their furlough days from 24 to 12 currently, and they're looking to reduce them even further. So I think that's another, I guess you would call it unintended consequence, where I think this bill would do harm. And I give you that as just a specific example. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Chair Hovley and the members of the House Business and Labor Committee, my name is Chuck White. I am the Executive Director for the Oregon School Personnel Association. OSPA represents over 200 members of HR professionals in Oregon school districts, and my comments basically is to affirm the testimony that Nancy Hungerford and Alan presented to you. We again believe that allowing an outside arbitrator to decide these types of issues is bad public policy, and as a result, the accountability for local districts is lost. And so with that, I'll pass it to Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Board, representing the locally elected school board members, of which there's a couple on this committee that have been on school boards before. Not to belabor any of the points that have already been made, but I do want to bring up the one about locally elected school board members are locally elected and accountable to the public. If you send this to an arbitrator, it takes it out of the hands. How can the public be how can the arbitrator be accountable to that decision, and a school board member be held accountable for an arbitrator's decision if it gets that far? So I just wanted that's a piece. I have a couple other instances where we had to go and use interim bargaining. Superintendent Karen Gray from Park Rose pointed out that right now State Board is involved in instructional hour changes, and that would be something where this may have to be used, the interim bargaining, to deal with that change. Another small district actually has in their contract reference 243-698. So both sides know what that means. If there's something that they need to bargain impact over, it's already in the agreement. And they had to use that. Let's see. The Affordable Care Act coming down the pike. Some payroll folks were having trouble with employees and monitoring the leave time, what they were being paid, and they need to make some adjustments so they could start payroll in January. Contracts were closed. That's something that they needed to use it as well. So again, just a few more examples, Mr. Chair, of the reason that it's needed. It's not used as often, again, as everybody has mentioned. And I'll close with that. Answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? I appreciate your testimony. I know you raise, I think, Mr. Bovet, you raised, you know, one of the primary, I guess, philosophical questions for us is should we, you know, I'm hearing that sometimes these interim issues come up and, you know, for financial reasons largely, and you need to make changes to balance the books. And I guess the question is, you know, if you're not able to come to an agreement with changing the contract to accomplish some of those financial efficiencies, you have to lay off people. And so I guess that's sort of the question. Should we make it easier for you to implement those? Because I'm hearing from the other side that those basically get implemented, those contractual changes, you know, in order to your effort to not lay off people and continue services. But at the same time, you're changing a contract by implementing it after the 90 days. And, you know, I guess the question is, how fair is that as a, you know, because it does seem to me that it sort of potentially is one-sided in those situations. Can you address that for me?
Chair Holvey, I think what the previous employer's representatives talked about in terms of the good faith of employers and the challenges to that addresses part of it. But I think Columbia County is a perfect example, again, to respond, because if this bill had been in place, there would be no employer option. So, yes, you would take the two proposals, one deeper layoffs, the other layoffs and furloughs, to arbitration 10 months later. It would be moot because the county would have already had to lay off all those folks. So this takes all employer options off the table.
That's assuming that you wouldn't come to some sort of mediated or agreed upon.
Right. Then they did.
I mean, you're
making
an assumption there would be no.
Right. And in Columbia County's case, they did go to mediation and didn't reach consensus. The parties were still apart on that issue. And so,
but after 90 days, am I correct that the county just implemented their final offer?
That's correct. Yes.
So I appreciate, I'm just trying to get that straight.
I do have one question.
Representative Doherty.
But I assume Columbia County waited a period of time as opposed to like a week after the contract had been ratified to go through and discuss this with the union?
Mr. Chair.
Because those are the bad players we're talking about that wait 10 minutes before after a ratification or up to a week.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I fully understand that point. That wasn't the case here in Columbia County. This was driven midterm by essentially Congress's mm-hmm. failure to act.
But the issue is that you didn't do it immediately after bargaining.
That's my understanding.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. And up next, we have been jumping around a little bit. Sarah Drescher, Stacy Cowan, and Bob Livingston. Good morning. Welcome to committee. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
I would, except I drank it all.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Drescher. I am an attorney with the Tedesco Law Group, and we represent the Oregon School Employees Association. The Oregon School Employees Association is a union that represents classified employees in the schools. In fact, almost all of the schools in Oregon that have classified employees have OSEA as their representative. These are the non-teachers. These are the people who are the cooks, who are the custodians, who are the instructional aides, who are the secretaries, the people who are working with those kids every day. I also represent firefighters. Our firm represents about 3/4 of the firefighters in the state of Oregon. And so we have the unique position in the sense that firefighters already use the interest arbitration process in expedited bargaining. And so we've seen that already work in our firefighter clients. Let me spend a quick minute talking about the history that brought us to expedited bargaining. Prior to Senate Bill 750 in 1995,
There was no time limit on bargaining. But Senate Bill 750 established two separate processes. It established the 150-day process for regular bargaining, which is what's used in most contracts, and it ends in mediation after 150 days. And then there's the midterm process for when you have a closed contract and an issue comes up, and that's where we get to this 90-day bargaining process that has no dispute resolution process. The expedited process has subverted the normal bargaining process in three critical respects. It did away with mediation of labor disputes. It created an environment where employers can make unilateral changes without engaging in any meaningful bargaining. And I'll give you the example of my very first case as an attorney, which was the Klatskanai School District in 2004. As soon as the ink was dried on their labor contract, the district provided the union with notice that we're getting rid of an early retiree benefit of providing certain health insurance for retirees. This was just within weeks after the contract had been signed. And for 90 days, the district came to the bargaining table and did not make a single bargaining proposal, not one, while the union made proposal after proposal to save it. And you know why? Because the district knew that after 90 days, it could unilaterally implement. And that's exactly what happened. And third, the problem with expedited bargaining is it presents the real possibility of strikes in the middle of a labor agreement, which is not good for the continuation of public services, for our communities, for our schools. As we all know, most disputes settle on the courthouse stairs because the sheer pressure of a dispute resolution process encourages parties to reach a resolution. But you have to have that courthouse, or at least those stairs, in order to encourage parties to compromise. And here, in the expedited bargaining, there's simply no pressure to reach that compromise because employers know there's no dispute resolution process. They have the ability to unilaterally implement after 90 days. And as a result, employers have used the expedited process instead of the regular process to make significant reductions in employee benefits, to reduce pay, and to contract out public jobs. The biggest problem we face at OSEA is the contracting out of our transportation services to First Student and other private bus companies. This eliminates all of those employee jobs, those bus drivers. And what we have seen is that districts will give notice to the union on June 1st, which happens to be right before the summer recess. They will bargain for 90 days when most of the classified employees aren't around, and they will implement by September 1st, at which time they already have a contract in place with the privatized employer, and those jobs are gone. And there's no one on the union side to mobilize against this, and it is catastrophic to the workers. It's a loss of family wage jobs, health insurance, and retirement. Now, this is not a hypothetical. This is a reality. And we've seen districts use the expedited process to try and contract out bus driver jobs in Willamina, Oak Ridge, Lowell, Winston-Dillard, and Park Rose. Five school districts have used the expedited process to contract out our public jobs. On the other hand, the 150-day bargaining process has widely been hailed as a success. There is real bargaining that takes place because there's a dispute resolution process that the parties are forced to go through. House Bill 2554 will resolve many of the problems in expedited bargaining because it inserts that dispute resolution process. And that pressure alone, I can tell you from representing firefighters who have that process, will lead to more resolution. You're not going to see exponential numbers of binding arbitration because no one wants to go. They're going to resolve their problems beforehand, and I can tell you most of all my firefighter clients will resolve their midterm 90-day bargaining issues without resorting to arbitration. But if they do, let me counter a few things that have been said by the employers. One is with respect to the expense. My law firm handles at least 5 arbitrations a month, and I can tell you on average an arbitrator's bill is around $5,000, and it's split equally between the parties. And with respect to unions trying to take advantage of this process to get to arbitration, let me remind you, the only way we ever get to expediting the process is if the employer proposes a change in the middle of the contract. So there's no way for the unions to somehow take advantage of this process. It will be up to the employers to do that. Do we want to make a change midterm? Or should we save this to the next contract negotiations if we can? And I suspect most employers, like Ms. Hungerford mentioned, are going to try and save it to the 150-day process, which is where the bargaining is supposed to take place anyway and resolves many of those issues I just discussed. And lastly, with respect to having shorter contracts, Ms. Hungerford is my worthy opponent on many of my cases. And she said that there's going to be shorter contracts because she's not going to advise her clients to enter into long contracts. Well, I can tell you, as Mr. Livingston will, firefighters, again, use this process in their expedited bargaining, and they have the same length of contracts that any of my school employees do. And furthermore, even if there was that concern, all attorneys in labor law know you can have a contract reopener within your contract that says we will reopen this particular provision or this one or if this happens. And oh, by the way, here's the bargaining process that will take place. We can choose to use that 150-day process. So these sky is falling arguments are really just an effort to avoid that dispute resolution process and maintain the ability to unilaterally implement after 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a firefighter in a very nearby city. But my comments today are specific to the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I'll be brief because it's always hard to follow Sarah, so I've got about 4 points that I want to make. I think the first point is one, this seems more like Groundhog's Day because you know those that have been in this process for a while know that the firefighters have been involved in quite a few collective bargaining issues and debates within this body. It feels more like Groundhog's Day rather than Valentine's Day, and the first point I think is the most important. This bill is simply this, and whether you agree or disagree with all of the dialogue, it's whether you believe that after a 90-day process, whether one side can unilaterally implement or not. If you think that's a good process, then you're probably not going to be supportive of this bill. If you think PECPA and bargaining was set up in order for both parties to discuss and address their issues, then maybe you want to take a closer look at this bill. And, you know, one of the points that I would make is Mr. Barber made great points. He talked about memorandums of agreement, memorandums of understanding. Well, that happens all of the time in the fire service and in public safety. When there's differences midterm, we can sit down. But the point that I would make is our process is much different than non-strikeable units because we do have the ability that if we don't agree with a mandatory subject, it goes through another process. So this is not going to stymie any discussions that take place when differences come across. What it's going to do, it's going to level the playing field. The second point I would like to make is on one hand, if you really listen to some of the opponents' testimony, on one hand, they want to say that, hey, this really doesn't happen very often. But then on the other hand, they want to argue that this is going to be devastating. In my way of thinking, it's either it doesn't happen very often or it happens a lot. And I can tell you that even in this situation, midterm bargaining, there's very few times this happens. But again, the employer can unilaterally implement. So I don't think you can have an argument both ways. The other thing that I don't think has been mentioned, and I think this is a key point. For years, for decades, if you're a public safety officer in Oregon and if you can't reach an agreement with your employer, you are required to go to mediation. It's a requirement before you even get to arbitration. And what I can happily report to you, in a wide majority of those cases, whether it's a full contract, whether it's a single issue, kudos, and I would hope the employers would agree with this, kudos to the Employment Relations Board and the mediation services, because a vast majority of those mediations end with a settlement agreement. Again, and the reason for that is because the next stake is arbitration. One point, though, and my final point that I would make is that I hope I can dispel this boogeyman theory that somebody from outside Oregon is going to make decisions for us. One, these arbitrators are well-trained. They're either attorneys or they have huge amount of backgrounds in the collective bargaining process. Two, whether they're from Hong Kong, Wisconsin, or Canby, they still have to follow the PECBA laws and the criteria that are established in 243 when they make a determining decision on which side they're going to settle with. Finally, the last point that I would make is that I think it's a good point that, one, you don't see uniforms in here today. That's a good point that in the public safety, where this is very rarely used, if this was a big bill and if the process didn't work correctly, I think you'd probably see more fire chiefs and police chiefs in uniforms here. And as far as elected officials, this process that 2544 will correct already occurs, and I don't, you know, fire district members are elected officials, city council members are elected officials, and my point is outside arbitrators have and continue to do that. So this notion of an outside person making a decision is simply a myth that's not there, because that's what happens for public safety units throughout the state of Oregon. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any testimony. This is a good bill, and it's a long overdue to finally correct this in the PECBA statutes.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Stacey Cowan with SEIU Local 503. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2544. We represent nearly 55,000 workers statewide, and that includes a number of local government workers. I won't repeat any of the testimony you've heard. I think a lot of smart people have said some good things. We just wanted an opportunity to add our voice to the discussion. As you've heard, the bill really addresses a huge problem with a system that unfairly disadvantages workers. House Bill 2544 is going to level the playing field and restore balance and effectively add a check to interim bargaining. We really believe that this just protects the spirit of collective bargaining. So we would encourage you to support the measure. And with that, thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Just a question. Is it Sarah? I didn't catch your last name.
Correct. Drescher.
Yeah. So this is I just found your testimony to be really compelling. Do you have it? I didn't notice yours in writing. Can you get us that in writing?
I have written testimony.
Do I have it?
It should be on OLIS.
Oh, on OLIS. Oh, that was the one on OLIS. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Mr. Chair, can I note that there's several pieces of testimony that were received that people did not come today to testify. So we have testimony from Beaverton, opposed, from Metro, opposed, letter from Eugene, Human Resources, opposed, City of Medford, opposed, and City of Salem, opposed. Those are all posted on OLIS or soon will be, but submitted for the public record.
Thank you. I appreciate your, Representative Widener. Question,
comment, because Bob sort of brought it up, and I've heard it multiple times. You've got all these people coming from Wisconsin. Do you think they're here because they're unemployed in Wisconsin since their right to work now?
Oh, God.
Just kind of.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony today. I hope you have a great weekend. With that, I will close House Bill 2544 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2214. Committee, I'd like, hopefully we can get through this last bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure includes Oregon nonprofit corporations as a public employer for purposes of transferring certain public employees. There are no amendments before you today.
I'd like to call up Joe Basler and Jennifer Chapman. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler, and Jennifer Chapman is with me. She's one of our attorneys. My new system is going to be bring someone smarter with me to testify. I just figured it out today, so if you have any questions, feel free to ask Jennifer.
I think we all agree that's a good practice. Just kidding. Sorry.
He's right.
Chair Holvey left. I had to get something to do.
Yeah, I know. Fair enough.
Apparently, I'm rubbing off on him.
So. I know.
Oh, here we go.
Oregon ASME represents, as I mentioned just previously, not too long ago, 24,000 members across the state. And a lot of those members sort of live in a regular I don't want to say fear, but concern that their job may be transferred or we call it outsourcing to some other group. And when a public employee gets moved to another public employer, they follow what's called the transfer statute, and they get to keep their wages and benefits for 1 year, their seniority, their some of their vacation time. Prior to 2013, also if they got transferred to a private nonprofit, they also would get to keep their wages and benefits for a year. The statute changed in 2013, I believe very unintentionally. If you go back and you feel free to listen to the testimony, I have several occasions. It was never discussed what happened. The original statute was written in a paragraph form, and it is, it's frankly kind of hard to read, and it really looked like they weren't included because of some punctuation. However, I do, like, just you don't have to take my word for it. There is an AG opinion from 1978, when that's how long nonprofits had been included. It actually spells out in great detail how a nonprofit would be able to keep wages and benefits. This was the law from sometime in the 70s, till 2013, and then they were excluded, frankly, as an unintended consequence. So we would like to include nonprofits back into that process. So if someone is transferred from a public employer to a nonprofit, say mental health, they're a mental health worker at Multnomah County, and they get moved to a private nonprofit, it wouldn't stop that process at all. I mean, they could do it. We might not like it, but they could do it. But they would get to keep their same wages and benefits for a year, to sort of let them glide down into the new position and not, I mean, because very likely it could happen someone could get transferred and go from having a good, frankly, union wage job to being not making minimum wage. And that sort of, that quick snap could really be damaging to families and communities across the state. There's been a question several representatives have asked me, what about PERS? This doesn't put nonprofits under PERS. In fact, PERS in the statute very clearly says if this would affect PERS in a negative way, their tax status, they can say no, you're not in PERS anymore, and then the new employer would have to give the equivalent of their contribution to that worker in some, like a 401k or their what retirement system they might already have. So like I said, it hopefully it's not as contentious as my last bill, but who knows. It could be. But that's pretty much what it does. It lets folks have a year to sort of figure out what they're doing after their job's been transferred. Thank you.
Would you like to testify, or have you already?
Chair Holby, representatives of the committee, I'm here to answer any technical questions that you may have about the background of this change and what
either
the law
name,
was prior to 2013.
And however, if you'd introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jennifer Chapman. I'm legal counsel with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. I would just echo what Mr. Basler has said and offer to answer any questions that the committee may have of me.
Questions, Representative Barreto.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holby. The Oregon nonprofit corporations, now these are private sector corporations, so it would be a public employee going over to a private sector nonprofit.
Yes, sir. Chair Holby, Representative Barreto. It doesn't happen all that often, but it does happen when a private nonprofit takes over some public service that the county has been doing, and the funding would usually still come through the state and the county to this private nonprofit, but they take over the actual work. So the employee who was, you know, a drug treatment counselor is now going to a nonprofit that's doing drug treatment counseling. So instead of working directly for the county, they now work for the nonprofit, but it's still a public service. It's just not being done by a public entity.
Well, follow up.
So then they are an employee of the corporation, not of the state.
Yes, absolutely. Chair Holby, Representative Barreto. Yes, they would be an employee of the. They would be. I have a new employer, and it would just sort of say that the object would be that the new employer has to keep that person's wage at the same level and for 1 year and give them equivalent benefits for that 1 year, for 12 months.
Thank you.
Representative Kinnamer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think an example that was explained to me, and I apologize, can't remember exactly who explained it. It's Douglas County. They've been divesting of a lot of their programs because of severe financial problems, and they transferred their mental health program to a private nonprofit to try and keep that alive. And yet these were former employees, so they're an example of these people who get caught in this mix, that they have accrued benefits, and this is a way to try to moderate that impact.
In these cases, are these nonprofits receiving funds from the state to or from the counties or wherever to accomplish these services?
Chair Holby, yes, that is correct. So this is public money going from one public entity into the private nonprofits to fund these programs. And I believe if you look at the legislative history and some of the case law that was developed prior to the change in 2013, and even since the change in 2013, what you'll see is that the drafters of the original law said that when you've got a public employee and you've got a government that needs to make changes for whatever reason, that public employee shouldn't suffer as a result of those changes. There should be some transition period, which actually works to the benefit of everybody involved, including the private nonprofits, because there's people that are, at least for approximately a year, have familiarity with the work, and that actually benefits everyone involved.
Did you have a question?
Could I ask
other questions?
Could I ask one more question?
Representative Barreto.
Chair Hovey, thank you. After a year, does the government continue to pay for that employee for a duration of time beyond that?
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, my understanding of the way that the law works is that after that one-year transition period, the employee's working conditions revert to whatever is covered under the nonprofit's employment structure. However, public funds, to the extent that they continue to subsidize or provide for the programs, there are intergovernmental agreements or contracts that provide for certain terms. And some of those contract terms after a year may say we want wages to be this. Some of them may not.
Thank you. So let me clarify. So after the year is up, they continue to receive the public funds to provide these services, but then the compensation package for the employees is subject to whatever the policies of the private nonprofit is.
Chair Holby, that is correct. The intent of the law is essentially to give a transition period to everyone involved, which has worked successfully in the past based on the experiences that I've had with the law.
But in the, I guess, overall picture, those services are now being provided with workers that are receiving probably a lower compensation package, making less money per hour or less benefits or whatever.
Chair Holby, that is correct, although that is what we perceive to be an unfortunate side effect of contracting out in these circumstances.
Yeah, it would seem like it would lower the ability of the local economy to have participation from workers, you know, at the level they're used to anyway. So is there an issue with this? I think I asked our committee administrator this, and I don't know that we've contacted PERS. How does somebody who's working for a private receive public benefits?
Chair Hovey, I know this.
That's one.
Boy, you know an answer. I'm so excited.
I know. Sorry.
I love it.
Chair Hovey, PERS actually spells out in the statute that if it does affect PERS in a way that would affect their tax status, that PERS can say you are no longer in PERS. We are not taking money from a private, because it affects their federal tax status as a qualified governmental entity. So what it would you would have to either then give a, if the nonprofit has a retirement account, then you would have to give in that retirement account a commensurate a contribution that you would have given to PERS. You would have to give it then to the other retirement account, whether that's a 401k or whatever. It wouldn't affect the at the back end. It wouldn't affect any of the actual benefits at retirement, but it would affect how much the employer has to contribute. If it they have no sort of retirement system, then they would have to donate enough to a 401k or something like that to sort of what they would have had for that year if under a public employer.
I'm glad you knew the answer. I'm not sure I understood it.
So pretty much if it hurts PERS, PERS can say, no, you're not in PERS anymore, is in the statute.
Okay. Understood, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Oh, Representative Widener.
So understand, so if the nonprofit doesn't have any sort of retirement, they have to put that amount into some sort of 401k for that employee.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes.
Chair Weiner. Chair Holby, Representative Weiner.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Wouldn't it be easier for them just to remain an employee of the state, basically subcontracted out to these people for a year? I mean, to start up a 401k for one employee or even a few, you know, seems unreasonable.
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, we would love them to remain members of the public employee. I think what it does, like as a counties and local governments or the state make these considerations with private nonprofits, we just want to make sure that that's part of the conversation.
Follow up.
Oh. And if I could just add to that, Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, the way that I've seen this particular issue dealt with in with other local governments that have transferred employees into private programs is that they work out a lot of these details on the front end. They involve the employees when the employees are represented. They involve the unions. And a lot of this is hashed out. And sometimes there are compromises made. Sometimes employees agree, you know, instead of doing a 401k, I want this instead. Mm-hmm. So that there are accommodations made. We're not trying to prevent the transferring out, although of course that is a concern, but certainly the intent of this bill is just to provide that transitional period and ensure that that conversation takes place.
Follow up.
It just seems like it would be much less confusing if the transition were on the part of the state retaining that employee, and then a year knowing that a year later they will be an employee of this corporation. And then it seems like that would simplify the whole process here that you're asking us to make legislation on.
And Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I would say that nothing in the proposal would circumvent the parties from agreeing to do that. This would just ensure that however the parties agree to make that transfer, there is in fact a transition period.
Thank you.
Yeah, I suppose another way to solve this would be to just simply not allow the state to transfer its employees to nonprofits to provide public services, because it seems like it has a contradictory impact on the wages, the average wages of Oregonians, to the negative, which is not really the what economists say that we should be doing. We should be trying to raise the wages of Oregonians.
Chair Holby, we think you're very wise.
Yeah. Just thought I'd throw that out.
Do that one, too.
I don't very often get a chance to
I think it's about it. Time to end the hearing. Excuse me.
On that note.
Okay, well, you know, I have to, you know, everybody else gets a chance to do that. So I take the prerogative today. So, well, I really appreciate your testimony, and I guess we'll talk some more about this as we go on. Jan, was there anybody else that wanted to testify on this particular bill? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. I will close House Bill 2214. Committee, thank you very much. We were able to get through our agenda, our light agenda today. And Jan, do we have anything else left? Anybody else have good of the order?
Question for you,
Monday
Mr.
night,
Chair.
Right?
Are we meeting Monday morning and Monday night?
Yes, that is correct.
That'll be fun.
I hope you have time to take a nap during the day. I hope your staff has scheduled that for you. It will be an important meeting on Monday. It's a very big issue for the legislature to deal with. So if you're at all able to be there Monday night to listen to the public hearing, I really suggest that. And committee, we've now completed our 2 weeks, and I just want to remind folks that if we can keep our comments and questions about the bill that's in front of us, it really does help us manage our time. So I appreciate that. And I also want to, we wanted to wait a couple of weeks to see how he worked out, but I want to introduce our new committee assistant, which we have not done yet this session. And so his 2 week probationary period, he successfully completed. I'm happy to announce that. Matthew Puckett is serving us well. He has not made one mistake in 2 weeks, so.
Good for him. He was here.
And so, welcome, Matthew, and we look forward to your service.
Mr. Chair, should we ask Matthew if he wants to adopt us, though?
That's not an issue that can be bargained. So with that, I will close the House Committee on Business and Labor for this Friday, the 13th, and happy birthday to the state of Oregon tomorrow. Yeah. Oregon tomorrow. Yeah.